Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is the Fight for 15 labor movement. On April 15th, fast food workers across the Bay Area, joined by childcare workers, adjunct professors, and others toiling for low pay, took to the streets to demand a $15 an hour minimum wage and a union. The workers joined some 60,000 other Fight for 15 demonstrators across the nation in what organizers say was one of the largest protests by low-wage workers in U.S. history. By many counts, the protests, which began as a series of strikes in November 2012 by New York fast food workers, are yielding change. Minimum wages are on the rise in Bay Area cities and Los Angeles, and New York plans to look into raising wages of the state's more than 180,000 fast food workers. But what more does the Fight for 15 movement aim to accomplish on the wage front, and will it succeed in securing a union for fast food workers? Can the campaign, as some contend, transform and re-energize the American labor movement? And what tactics, strategies, and partnership will it need to employ in the process? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are Jenny Lin, Deputy Director of the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, an Oakland nonprofit dedicated to advancing economic, racial, and social justice in the East Bay. Jenny has been organizing in the student, environmental justice, and labor movements since 1998. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you.
We're also joined in studio by Chris Higginbotham, a campaigner for the Fight for 15 movement. He is also a middle and high school U.S. history and government teacher at Oakland's Patton Academy and a cashier at a McDonald's in Oakland. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
I'd like to get started with you, Jenny. Can you kind of describe what this movement is? What are the main goals that Fight for 15 is fighting for?
Sure. So this movement really started 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, the fight for $15 in a union was unthinkable. And when we look at the campaign now, it's absolutely unstoppable. It started out with workers, I believe it was 200 workers out in New York City, fast food workers who walked off the job 2 years ago. And it really sent ripple effects across the country. Worker by worker, you know, store to store, city by city, all the way to this last strike where over 200 cities were engaged and involved in some sort of fast food worker strike. So it's really been this movement that has taken over the country and really energized people locally around the need for a higher minimum wage, $15, and the need for a union.
You talked about 2 years from now, where you started to now and the dramatic change. What has caused that change?
It's been really rooted in workers, workers like Chris and his coworkers at McDonald's, at Burger King, at a number of fast food restaurants, workers standing up and saying that they deserve more. It's also an increased recognition that by a number of people that fast food companies can afford to pay more. We've got a fast food industry that's some $200 billion in profits every year, and yet they're saying they can't pay fast food workers $15 an hour. So it's been this broad-based coalition and consensus among workers, among residents, among people of faith, and even some supportive small businesses.
Chris, I want to talk in a little bit about your combination of interesting jobs. But before we get into that, how did you get involved with Fight for 15?
I got involved when I was at my McDonald's the summer before I was going into my teaching job. I was thinking about not working there anymore. And a person that was trying to start up the union came to me and was like, hey, we're starting up a fast food union. So I was like, oh, cool. I know all about unions. My parents are both in unions. Oh, let me go tell my coworkers. They'll be excited. Boom. And just jumping. And when I told my coworkers, they didn't understand it. And at that moment in time, I realized that my mom's always taught me that's an injustice when you see injustice happens and you don't try to make a change. So by me understanding that unions are important and they help people have their jobs with security and also with benefits, it made me realize I needed to stay on with this movement and grow. And so since then, I've been part of it. So 2 years ago.
What unions do your parents belong to?
Oh, my parents belong with SEIU. Both of them. So,
yeah. And SEIU has been very involved in the Fight for 15 movement, which we'll turn back to in a second. I want to now, though, go to a third guest who was just able to join us on the phone. Joining us on the phone is John Logan, an associate professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State's College of Business. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be on.
Really appreciate you joining us. I was wondering if you could provide some perspective here on the Fight for 15 movement. How unique is it right now when you look at the overall labor landscape in the country?
Well, it is very significant. I mean, as has been said before, it's the biggest mobilization of low-wage workers in this country for some time, probably many decades. The U.S. labor movement has always said that it represents the entire working class, but it, you know, organizes only the organizable. And, you know, until very recently, most people would have thought that fast food workers were not organizable. It really wasn't possible to form unions of fast food workers, or that the idea that fast food workers win a wage of $15 an hour was fanciful. But you know, really, this movement in a relatively short period of time, about 2.5 years, has really transformed those perceptions. Now the idea of a $15 a minimum wage for fast food workers no longer seems like a crazy idea. In fact, you know, it's already being realized in a number of cities across the country, and you know, with recent actions in L.A. and New York, you know, it's likely that you know the number of fast food workers and other low-wage workers who will be getting $15 an hour in the near future will be increasing, and also the idea that you know you could actually have a union at a company like McDonald's, which has been the primary target of this movement, no longer seems like an impossibility. So, you know, in that sense, the movement is very significant. And, it, you know, as I said, in a short period of time, it's achieved a remarkable amount.
Thank you, John, very much for providing that context. Jenny, what were the challenges when you got started? So fast food workers, you know, McDonald's, they have franchisees. It's not just like one company. I know that was something that you had to overcome from the beginning. What? Tell us more about that, as well as some of the other challenges that you foresaw when you started this a couple years ago. And how are you able to overcome many of them to have the success you've had so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's been a combination of things. As I mentioned, there is this growing consensus in many cities that the current minimum wage in California of $9 an hour is just not enough to live off of. $9 an hour in the Bay Area is something like, you know, $1,500 a month. That's barely enough to afford the average rent in the Bay Area. So there's this growing consensus that the current minimum wage, that workers and fast food workers can't make it on $9 an hour. So workers joined by residents and people of faith and supportive small businesses have started to push for a higher minimum wage. So to get to that $15 an hour. And as John said, more and more cities across the East Bay, across the country are raising their minimum wage with a path to 15. So we've seen just in the last year, in 2014, there were 7 cities in California that raised their minimum wage. And then just this in the past 6 months, we've had from the smallest city of Emeryville to the largest city of Los Angeles, raising their wages to $15 an hour. So it's really been this, as John mentioned too, this energizing aspect led by fast food workers that has really pushed these minimum wages across California and hopefully across the country.
Are you surprised by how quickly this has happened? There's been a huge shift on this issue.
Mm-hmm. I am surprised, but also really, it gives me a lot of hope. You know, both Chris and I were involved in the Lift Up Coalition in Oakland to raise the minimum wage. We saw it pass by 82% supermajority of voters. It had widespread support. Even some, you know, small businesses, what some might think are unlikely allies, but we feel like absolutely, you know, are on our side and see that raising wages means more money in our local economy. It's really helped pull people together. And, you know, the fact is that before these minimum wage policies were passed, worker wages have been declining for decades. The real power, you know, real value of wages have been declining over time. And so it's really important that the fast food workers have been at the forefront of these minimum wage campaigns in helping us pass these policies city by city.
Chris, let's get back to your personal story. So you are teaching U.S. history and government at Oakland's Patton Academy while also holding down a job at McDonald's. How common or uncommon is of that with your teacher colleagues?
With my teacher colleagues, it's pretty uncommon. But across the nation and with my friends from Morehouse and everything, it's pretty common that people have two jobs. In this economy, a lot of people are not able to survive, definitely, just coming out of college with student loans and just this, just the economy still being in the recession.
Which job came first for you?
The McDonald's job. I had that for now 6 years. So it happened right after my senior year in high school, summer job. Then I kept it on for when I came back from winter breaks in summer.
And do your students know that you have these two jobs?
Yeah, my students do know. Actually, a couple of students have stopped by and said hi before. So.
And do your fellow teachers know as well?
A couple of my fellow teachers know. They asked me about it.
And how? What do you think it says about how tough it is for young people getting jobs today that can support themselves in an expensive area like the Bay Area?
I think it shines a lot of light. I mean, I think most of the time we get overlooked in the sense that, hey, you got your degree, go out and get a job, when that's not real reality right now. There's people that have work experiences for years and still can't find a job in this type of economy, and definitely in the Bay Area, how expensive it is. We have to, you know, do different jobs, or we have to be freelancers, or we're also having a regular job. It's just tough.
And what would it mean to have a $15 an hour wage, not just in the cities that have passed them, but throughout the state for people who are working in fast food jobs?
I think it, for all of us, it will help. It will help people be able to save. It will also be able to help people to live a life. I think many times people believe that the $15 is to somehow get a yacht or something. No, it's just for people just to have groceries on the side and actually, you know, maybe take their kid out somewhere, venture off. There's many people that have this type of low wage in Oakland and have never even been to San Francisco. That to me is quite amazing and disappointing at the same time, and that we don't look at that. So I think it'd be beneficial for the economy and for just people and this happiness.
Jenny, it's not it. Fast food workers are kind of the leaders in a way in this, but there are many, many other low wage workers who you've brought on board. Can you talk about what those groups are and how you've reached out to them to get people to have solidarity with one another?
Sure. So it's been a combination of workers who are low-wage workers across various sectors. So fast food workers joining with workers at Walmart, with hotel workers, with a number of different workers in traditionally low-wage sectors saying enough is enough, that our work is the backbone of the economy and we deserve to be paid a fair wage. So that's included, you know, a number of different sectors. I think folks mentioned adjunct professors, childcare workers, again, a number of different sectors who are banding together and fighting for $15 in a union. So with workers, low-wage workers at the core, it has really energized a number of constituencies. And for us, I want to talk a little bit about both people of faith and also small businesses, supportive small businesses. Last November, we had a big campaign to reach out through congregations and churches to educate folks in Oakland about this measure. And a lot of people in the churches, this message about being able to work and not be in poverty really resonated with a lot of people. And so, you know, people of faith, I think, thinking about a moral economy, really support this effort to make sure that when people work, that they can be lifted out of poverty. There were also a number of supportive small businesses who realize that they're not like McDonald's and they're not like the big corporations, that they want to do right by their workers because those workers are like family to them. And they also, small businesses who recognize an extra dollar here or there in wage will actually get spent in those local businesses, in the local pizzerias and restaurants and that kind of thing. So we had a small but growing group of small businesses who were ready to step out and say, it may not be easy in the short term, but I know this is absolutely the right thing to do.
Well, that's very interesting because you hear that some of the main opposition to this sometimes are small business people who say, hey, I'm barely surviving as it is. I definitely want to help my workers, but my margins are just so small that I just wouldn't be able to stay open. What do you say to a small business person like that?
Well, we know that small businesses are very creative. They're in some ways just as creative as some of the low-wage workers who've had to figure out how to make it on $9 an hour, how to put food on the table, how to keep a roof over their heads. We also know that many small businesses are incredibly creative and innovative as well. They're making ways to figure out how to compete with some of those big corporations and big companies. And so we want to build on that. That innovation and that creativity is absolutely critical. And to show that there are many workers who will say, look, if I have a few extra dollars, I'm going to be able to take my family out to dinner at your local pizzeria. And that's really going to help our economy as a whole.
Let's take a short break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we are discussing the Fight for 15 labor movement with Jenny Lin, Deputy Director of the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, Chris Higginbotham, a campaigner for the Fight for 15 movement, and John Logan, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State's College of Business. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you worked in a fast food restaurant or in another minimum wage job? Tell us about your experiences. Do you support the Fight for 15 movement? Do you support the recent increases in the minimum wage in Bay Area cities? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment on our website at klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. John Logan from San Francisco State, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. And one question I have here, and I'd like to hear from all of you on this, is I know that SEIU, one of the biggest unions, has been very involved in the Fight for 15 movement, though fast food workers are not in a union yet. They're not SEIU members and, in fact, would like to start their own labor union. So, John, the way SEIU seems to see it is they're getting huge gains for all kinds of workers, whether they're members of SEIU or not. Is this different, John, than the way labor movements have worked in the past? Is this a new trend that we could be seeing of a movement focusing not just on its own workers, but on all workers?
Yeah, I think it's very much that. I mean, what we know, and, you know, over the past few decades, what we've seen multiple times is that it's extremely difficult for workers to organize under the National Labor Relations Act. You know, there are so many things that individual employers can do to intimidate, to coerce workers, to get them to vote no in union elections. In response to that, unions have, in the last two decades or so, engaged in what we call comprehensive campaigns, where it's not just about organizing workers at the workplace, but it's about putting pressure on the employer through a whole number of different means to try and get them to remain neutral and try and, you know, get them to allow the workers to make the decision to form a union for themselves. But those types of campaigns are very resource intensive. They often last a very long time. And so I think what SEIU and perhaps some other parts of the labor movement have decided is that, you know, if you're going to organize outside of the law, so to speak, not to go through the official National Labor Relations Board election system, you kind of need to do it as part of a mass movement. And that really is what the Fight for 15 is all about. You know, as has been said before, the focus has been on fast food workers, but there are a number of others, adjunct professors, home care workers, industrial laundry workers, and a bunch of others who are participating in this. It's really spread around the country, and some workers are getting the $15 an hour through legislation in cities like Los Angeles just in the last couple of weeks. In New York, it looks like fast food workers will get a higher wage through the action of the government, the governor. through a pay review commission, which is a process that does not require legislative approval. So it's a movement that's raising the wages for workers and raising standards for workers in a whole number of different ways around the country. And as you said, it's not just bastard workers, it's a whole number of different groups of low-wage workers. I mean, we should keep in mind that 42% of the American workforce, according to a recent study by the National Employment Law Project, earn less than $15 an hour. It's a huge number. In industries like fast food, it's over 90% who earn less than $15 an hour. Disproportionately women, disproportionately African-American, Latinos, etc. So the workers stand to benefit from the fight for 15, not just fast food workers, and it may not be by simply by forming a union, although we might actually get to the stage where they're allowed to vote without intimidation on whether or not they actually want a union at some of these billion-dollar fast food companies. But already they're seeing the dividends of this campaign. And as I said, I think, you know, that there is a feeling amongst sections of the labor movement that if you're going to see both a revival in the labor movement, but also if you're going to improve workers' wages and labor standards in a meaningful way, you really have to do it as part of a mass movement. And this is, you know, what the Fight for 15 is trying to create.
That's John right. Logan from San Francisco State, thank you very much. Jenny Lin from the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on a point about unions in this discussion. And I think it's important that to recognize that the organizations and unions, like those organizing in fast food, have really been infusing energy into the labor movement about thinking more broadly, addressing issues that affect all workers. And let's not forget that this is not necessarily something that's new. The labor movement in its heyday worked on issues like occupational health and safety, child labor laws, the 40-hour work week. These are policies and regulations that benefited all workers. And so I think it's really because of the organizing that's happening in the fast food campaign that maybe someday making less than $15 an hour is going to be the equivalent of a child working in a factory, right? So this is the type of movement that we're seeing, this changing in attitude and changing in what's expected. I did also want to ask Chris to talk a little bit. You know, David, you asked us about what are some of the challenges in the organizing. And I know folks like Chris and his coworkers see some of the challenges every day in terms of making sure, for example, that $12.25 an hour in Oakland is being enforced. And I wanted, you know, Chris, if you can talk a little bit more about what's happening in some of the stores as the wages are going up and what are some of the issues that workers are facing.
Thank you for that, because that is where I want to turn it. You said earlier that you went to your colleagues thinking, oh, yeah, they're going to be all excited about this union thing. And they were kind of like not getting it. So really, really would like to hear about what your experience have been like. Obviously, you went in coming up in a union household, understanding the benefits of a union and what it means for workers. So tell me how you have been able to spread that message with your coworkers and what the challenges have been.
First challenge is people just understanding what a union is. Once you get that, then it's how to go about it. Do we just sign the union card, or do we just show up to a few meetings and everything happens? It's like, no, there's a process. There are strikes. You know, there's a process when you do even have the minimum wage go up, like we have in Oakland, also in San Francisco, which I'm pretty sure is happening too in some places. Wage theft. What wage theft is when you work 40 hours a week, but you're only getting paid when your paycheck comes 35 hours.
And how common is that you personally have seen or heard of?
Oh, that's pretty common. I've almost heard that at every McDonald's franchise that I know in the East Bay. So, and that's just McDonald's. I've definitely heard some stories from Jack in the Box.
So what can a worker do in that situation?
In that situation, that's why they ask you, definitely we tell everybody to keep their stubs. Mm-hmm. So they bring their stubs in. We come to the store manager or the franchise owner or the corporation, if it's a corporate owned, and we talk to them and say, where is these hours going? Because we're looking at the stubs and they're not adding up. Where this happened? And most of the time they get quickly reversed, but they with no explanation. They try not to explain, say, oh, there's something wrong with the system. But when it happens more than one time and to different people on numerous occasions. I don't see that.
How often does the system make a mistake and you get too much in your paycheck?
Too much in your paycheck? That never happens.
Okay.
So that's why I look at it.
How common in your overall organizing a problem is wage theft with low-income workers?
I think wage theft and the problem of retaliation is huge. I mean, we have workers who have been working at a fast food restaurant for years, if not decades, that once they stand up for their rights under a minimum wage policy or, say, bring up issues of the workplace, suddenly their immigration status is an issue when it wasn't before, or suddenly other issues arise. And I think, you know, that for an industry where in Oakland, there is an about 78% of the workforce that would benefit from an increase in the minimum wage were people of color, majority Latino and Black, as John mentioned. This is an issue where time and again, workers need protections when they are trying to fight for their rights under the law that are due to them under the law. They face increased intimidation and retaliation, and in some cases, they're fired for raising their rights.
You know, you mentioned immigration, and I'd really like to talk about the overlap here, because a lot of low-wage workers may not have legal status in the United States, and so they're particularly vulnerable to be taken advantage of. Tell me about your interaction with that group of people and how you're able to get them involved when they have an even higher risk than the average person if they really come forward and protest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really because of some courageous workers who are standing up and saying, it doesn't matter what my immigration status is. It didn't matter when you hired me. It didn't matter when I was the employee of the month. And somehow when I'm raising concerns about wage theft, suddenly it matters. And it's really the courage of workers themselves who are standing up and calling out the hypocrisy of that. It's also the broader community who is not going to stand for that. And also the recognition that if a manager can use an immigrant worker's status against them, what's to keep that manager from discriminating against a Black worker, from getting hired or getting the right schedule, et cetera. So there's been a lot of work within the fast food worker movement to also be in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the immigrants' rights movement, to bring these movements together, recognizing that poverty wages can't just be addressed on their own, that we need to be working in these broad coalitions. There are also a number of faith communities that have come out and said immigrant workers are humans. They are workers just like everyone else, and they deserve to be paid.
Let's take a short break and then continue discussing these issues. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the Fight for 15 labor movement with Jenny Lin, Deputy Director of the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, Chris Higginbotham, campaigner for the Fight for 15 movement, and John Logan, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State's College of Business. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have fast food experience? What do you think about the recent increases in the minimum wage around the Bay Area? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. John Logan from San Francisco State, let's bring you back in here. You have studied pushes for higher wages at Walmart in the Seattle area as well over at the airport there. Can you describe some of the key differences and similarities in these movements with the fast food workers movement?
Well, I mean, I think there are, as you said before, a lot of similarities. I mean, one of the things that the Fight for 15 and the fast food campaign has done is it's really changed our perceptions of who low-wage workers are. I mean, these are not, as the industry has often claimed, entry-level jobs for teenagers. They're not summer jobs. I mean, these are often jobs that are held by people who are significantly older, in their late 20s or early 30s, who are significantly more educated, typically have finished high school, often have some college education, and often are the main breadwinners within their families. And as you said, you are in the fast food industry, for one, are issues like wage theft are very important and very, very common. The similarities, again, the campaign to organize Walmart workers has been going on for the past few years. It started slightly earlier than the fast food campaign. They too are pushing for a living wage for Walmart workers, against a company and a corporate culture that really has no intention of providing that for them. Both Walmart and McDonald's have provided some raises recently for workers in response to the pressure that they've felt from these campaigns, but really nothing that is nearly adequate to providing a living wage. Both sets of workers face management retaliation, which has been very well documented and widespread in the case of Walmart. In the case of McDonald's, the National Labor Relations Board is currently considering a number of cases against alleging retaliation by McDonald's management, and addressing the question as to whether or not McDonald's should be considered a so-called joint employer in these cases, meaning that the responsibility for the anti-union actions, the retaliation against workers, is not just the responsibility of the franchise managers, but actually of the McDonald's central corporation, of the billion-dollar corporation that really has the power and really calls the shots in the company's practices and its pay structures and everything else. So there are a great many similarities. You mentioned Seattle. I mean, in a sense, this all started in SeaTac. The town around the Seattle airport, outside of Seattle, originally as part of an organizing campaign, but then as a ballot initiative to get a $15 an hour minimum wage, which passed, was subsequently passed also in Seattle. And almost every time voters have gotten to vote on higher minimum wages, they've approved them, and this has been true in Republican states as well as Democratic states. So, there's very good reason to believe that there's very broad-based public support for a much higher minimum wage. So I think, that there are more similarities, between McDonald's workers, Walmart workers, and the other low-wage workers, airport workers and others, than there are differences. The franchise system in the fast food industry complicates the situation a little bit, but it's really just the case of the companies trying to hide behind the franchise system, trying to deny responsibility for the poverty wages and for the management retaliation. That's really the major difference.
Thank you very much, John Logan from San Francisco State. We're going to go to the calls now. Again, the number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we have Mark from San Leandro on the line. Mark, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Great program. And what the professor just had to say is heartening. I just mentioned to your lady who answered the phone, I've been up in Canada, Canadian myself, and you really get a perspective coming back here how wacky it is. And the Canadians have dealt with this, and people are in favor of it. The quality of life is an important, important mainstay of their political system. And lastly, I would add that what I see, again, having a bit of perspective, is it's such a powerful issue because it's local. Everybody can pick it up. You don't have to worry about Walker and Koch and Clinton. You know, those people haven't got a human bone. I mean, they're just hired hands. So, but it's powerful in Oakland, that's not a rich place, decides we're going to take care of our people. That sends a very powerful message.
Mark, thanks for the call. You know, he mentioned that he was from Canada. How does the U.S. Compare to other countries in terms of how we treat our low-income workers?
Well, I know in advance of the last fast food strike on April 15th, there was a lot of talk about how these same companies, McDonald's and Burger King, they paid upwards of $20 an hour in other countries like Denmark and countries in Europe. And so they're showing that it can be done. It's a matter of the will to do it and the matter of making it a priority that workers who work, you know, for these billion-dollar companies should be paid a fair wage.
Yeah, I would add to that it's absolutely true that, you know, in countries like Denmark and Australia and elsewhere, McDonald's workers are paid significantly higher than in the U.S. and have better work conditions. So, that, you know, which shows that there's nothing inevitable, that, you know, these have to be low-wage jobs with poor labor conditions, but also workers in many of these countries have unions in service industries. Even at some of these companies, Walmart, McDonald's are notoriously anti-union companies, they have unions in other countries, and you know it's because. The law offers far greater protection for workers' right to organize in these other countries. Unfortunately, in the U.S., the law offers very weak protection, and employer opposition to unions, particularly in among companies like McDonald's and Walmart, is extremely strong. You have higher wages, you have better work conditions, and often it's because the companies are unionized.
Thank you very much, John Logan from San Francisco State. Jenny Lin from the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy. You know, we've talked some about the minimum wage hikes going on in California. Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Oakland are all set to go to $15 in the coming years. Emeryville to $16 an hour. Mm-hmm. Many other cities have different things in process right now. There's been just an incredible change in a short period of time on this. Since that is happening, is there an argument that the wage objectives have been met? What sustains this movement if you're actually having so much success? These people are already at 15, and Emeryville, they're even at 16.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at $15 an hour, absolutely it's a minimum, right? $15 an hour is $31,000 a year. In the Bay Area, that's barely enough to make ends meet. And so it's a minimum. It's a starting point. It's to where we start, but not by any means where we should end. So there is this push, and again, fast food workers have been the forefront of it, to say, okay, $15 now, and we need to go up from there, that there need to be sustainable wages, that there needs to be a union, that there needs to be protections around health and safety and other issues that come up on the job. So we're not done yet.
Well, let me ask about that specifically, about the benefits of forming a union, because the recent successes, some people have said, you know, that forming a union is no longer as important. It's going to put pressure as a movement on politicians to pass laws that raise wages for everybody, mm-hmm. rather than having to go to the negotiating table with one particular company. As John Logan from San Francisco State explained, the laws have made it more and more difficult to be successful there. So you're handcuffed in many ways, whereas there seems to be much more success now with these broader pushes. Mm-hmm. Forming a union is still one of the big goals here. So right. Both Jenny and Chris, I'd like to hear from both of you. Why don't we go with you first, Chris, a campaigner at Fight for 15. Why is forming a union an important part of your goals?
Forming a union is the most important part of our goal, due to the fact that because people make $15 an hour, it does not mean they're going to get the same hours. There have been where the minimum wage has lifted up in Oakland, and people have went from 40 hours down to 20 hours. So basically, they're making the same amount of money. For less hours. That's what we're asking for. But with a union, you're able to keep your hours with also your paycheck. And on to the point when you say asking politicians for minimum wage to increase for all, we all hope that, and we all hope that our person does that, but we also are smart enough to know that we've asked politicians for years for things to happen and nothing has changed. So at time as people, you have to stand up for yourself and rise above. And that's what Fight for 15 is about. It's not just about the money. I think people take the 15 and run with it, but they don't understand that the union and the dignity of these people matter most.
Very, very well put. Jenny, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that it has really, again, ignited a movement. So not just among fast food workers, but among a whole community of people who are standing with fast food workers and saying you're not alone, that if you're going to take that risk and stand up for $15 or stand up because you're getting more burns on your hands because you're having to work faster and under more pressure, that you're going to have people standing side by side, you know, other workers, residents, people of faith, supportive small businesses saying, we're with you. We're here for $15 in a union.
Can you tell us more about burns on your hands? I know there have been a lot of stories circulating about this. And so, Chris, I'm interested what kind of occupational hazards you see in the workplace.
For the burns to start off, the kitchen people are always getting burned and not having like a proper first aid kit. People tell them just to put mustard on it.
Mustard on it.
Yeah, mustard. We've had problems with, you know, in some of the stores where it's leakage when rain happens, and they just is like, oh, here's a bucket that goes over, bucket overfills, and there's water everywhere, and they're like, all right, cool, just get another bucket. Also, we have smoke from the fry sometimes too much, and there's like no like smoke detector or anything that goes off or anything. You just know because there's a lot of smoke. It's like just open up the door. So it's a lot of hazards that go on that a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, and because people's hours are getting cut in some places where there's fewer workers who are having to do the work of, you know, two people, and with their hours being cut and having to work faster, and that causes a lot of stress, and that can cause, you know, some of these issues that Chris is talking about burns and about other health and safety issues on the job.
Speaking of hours, what about the recent efforts to have more standardized hours so that people can plan for childcare, plan for other things that they need to do in these jobs? I know there's a lot of movement around the country on this issue to say, hey, you can't be a working mom or dad and have your boss call and change your schedule on short notice 2 days later. Mm-hmm. How are you possibly going to get the kids to school, pick them up, and so forth? Can you talk about that issue and how that's playing into the larger campaign?
Yeah, so there is we know in many of the traditionally minimum wage jobs, whether that's retail or food service, more and more jobs are becoming part-time jobs. And so people are having to cobble together two or three jobs in order to make ends meet. And part of this movement has been this issue to try to get to, you know, a 40-hour work week and to have some predictable schedules. San Francisco passed a policy that is, I believe, about to go into effect. And it's an important aspect. I think more and more, yes, minimum wages are core, but things like fair hours, like paid sick days, like all of these things that workers need, it's becoming more and more obvious that minimum wage is one part of a sort of comprehensive protections that workers need. So, yes, you get your minimum wage rate, but as Chris mentioned, if you don't have hours, that doesn't matter. You get your minimum wage raised, but you don't get paid sick days. So you might have, as you know, Shonda, another fast food worker, said, she came home with a paycheck of $32 before she got paid sick days because she had to take unpaid days off to take care of herself and her children. So these are important policies. Absolutely, minimum wage is core, and the fast food worker campaign has made that $15 the new normal. But there are all these other protections that are needed as well.
Let's take a final station break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the Fight for 15 labor movement with Jenny Lin, Deputy Director of the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy. Chris Higginbotham, a campaigner for the Fight for 15 movement, and John Logan, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State's College of Business. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. And here we have an email from Joanne. Joanne writes in, once you join a union, you get your wage increase, but you have to pay dues, pay portion of your health insurance. So are you really getting a wage increase after costs? Who'd like to take that one? Chris? All right, John, jump in, please. This is John Logan from San Francisco State's College of Business.
The answer is, categorically yes. I mean, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out data for anyone to see for non-union and non-union workers in retail, in fast food, in retail and every other sector of the economy. And we know that in terms of wages and very importantly in terms of other benefits, unionized workers do far better than their non-union counterparts in the same sectors. And as was said before, I mean, this is not just about wages. I mean, minimum wage is often an absolutely critical issue for non-union workers because it's the only protection they have. An increased minimum wage is the only protection they have against poverty wages. But unionized workers are able to negotiate over all of these other issues are also critical about more predictable scheduling, about full-time work, about pensions, about health care, about paid vacation, about paid sick leave, and all these other issues. So, unionized workers pay dues. I mean, this is how, unions as organizations are able to maintain themselves, are able to represent the workers. But there's absolutely no doubt that unionized workers in this country do significantly better than their non-union counterparts. And there's also no doubt that the stagnating wages that we've seen over the past three or four decades and the increase in low-wage service sector jobs, the 42% of the workforce we're talking about to earn less than $15 an hour, is in large part because of the huge decline in private sector unionization that we've seen over the past few decades.
Thank you. That's John Logan, associate professor at San Francisco State. Chris Higginbotham, your campaigner for Fight for 15.
What I would like to say to that is, there's dues, but for that dues, for people to have a voice and talk about the issues they're having with work, pays off. And that's a different payoff. I think many people are just looking at the payoff from the money. There's also a payoff with having a union and having support, having the voice of saying, hey, we got burns and we don't have a first aid kit, or hey, we don't have schedules up 2 weeks or even a week before what's going on, so I can't plan out my life. The balance of that safety and feeling that you have somebody that will actually take your voice and keep it going to the corporation is way bigger than the money that you're going to give up in those dues.
And Jenny, do you find that the folks you organize feel the same way?
Absolutely. I mean, it's incredibly, well, we've seen time and again, so in the same industry, a non-union worker, they are making that minimum wage, or maybe they are making, now that we've lifted these minimum wage to $15, but then the unionized worker in that same sector, if you put in the cost of health care and other benefits, that's like over $20 or $25. So the monetary benefits are definitely there, in addition to, as Chris has mentioned, the sort of the collective nature of a union and the ability to collectively bargain as well as collectively address other issues that are coming up at the work site.
And as a longtime organizer, to what extent do the issues for that can be addressed with an employer, to what extent do you try to also push for broader changes that can help workers? Say it's better housing, better transportation, more effective social programs. Can you tell us about whether you organize around those issues as well?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we, for many of us who are here in the Bay Area, we're recognizing that the Bay Area is changing very rapidly, that we're in danger of losing the real cultural identity and the real fabric in a lot of our communities. I've lived in Oakland for 10 years. It's really not that long. Chris has been born and raised in Oakland. He's seen things change over those years. But even in the 10 years that I've lived in Oakland, I've watched condo buildings go up with very little benefit for the people who live right there in the community. And so we know that raising wages and improving conditions in the fast food industry and other low-wage industries is absolutely critical. But we also need to address issues like displacement and gentrification and affordable housing. We know that people are having to move farther and farther away from where they work in order to afford rents and afford housing. And so jobs is a key place to start, but we can't stop there. We need to be addressing issues like affordable housing, like transportation, and tying those things together.
John, I'd like to let you come in here. We've talked a lot about what's happening in California. We talked some about what's happening around Seattle, Washington. But New York, under Governor Cuomo's leadership, is also very involved in this issue. Can you kind of describe what's happening in New York right now?
Yeah, so they have a particular system in New York where the governor can refer the issue of low wages for a particular sector, in this case fast food, obviously, although he previously has done the same for tipped workers and hotel industry, to a pay commission, which can then recommend a wage increase for that sector to New York's labor commissioner. And if the labor commissioner, the panel has to provide evidence that there is indeed a problem of low pay within that particular sector. If the labor commissioner accepts the recommendation, then the governor has the authority without going through the legislature to raise the wages of fast food workers. And that's what we're expecting to happen in New York. And Governor Cuomo,
is that unique to New York, or are there other states that have a similar setup?
I'm not sure. I mean, I suspect there are others, but New York is the one I know of. But the reasons, I mean, it's very clear the reasons he said that he intends to act upon this. I mean, Governor Cuomo is typically quite a cautious governor. But, he says that he has pointed out that the state of New York currently massively subsidizes the fast food industry to the tune of hundreds of dollars per employee.
Now, that's a great point, and actually something I wanted to get to, John.
So he wants New York to get out of the business of subsidizing the fast food, and New York taxpayers to get out of the business of subsidizing the fast food industry. He thinks that the appropriate way to do it is to raise wages for fast food workers, not to tax the companies or to impose burdenous regulations on them. And, I would have thought that this is a solution that, most people would agree, even people who believe in small government, should agree with the idea that, the companies should be required to pay their employees enough so that that taxpayers don't end up subsidizing them, as they do in California as well as New York. But in New York, to a greater degree than any other state in the country, as far as we know. And so this will be another way that fast food workers will get a raise. But ultimately, I think, the campaign for a union and an end to retaliation will continue in New York even after they get the raise.
Thank you very much. That's John Logan from San Francisco State. Jenny, John mentioned an issue that came up earlier also about the public benefits that low-income workers have to receive to make ends meet, and the fact that corporations, be it Walmart or fast food, they are basically subsidized by the governments with their workers.
Right.
Can you talk about the situation that you find workers in? And then, Chris, we only have a few minutes left, but I'd love to hear your perspective on that as well, in terms of how common is it that low-income workers are on various forms of public benefits as well?
So I'll just throw out a couple of numbers to support what John just talked about, and then Chris should talk about the direct experience on the ground. So,
right.
You know, there have been reports from the UC Berkeley Labor Center, 52% of fast food workers nationally are paid so little that they have to rely on public assistance for basic food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. This is for an industry that, again, makes $200 billion in profits every year. In California alone, it's $717 million annual subsidy to fast food corporations who pay their workers poverty wages. So, Chris, if you can talk about, you know, what you see on the ground in terms of workers and their families.
People are not able to put the lights on. Just to tell you a quick story. So me being a teacher, I had one student that called me out of class and was like, "Hey, Mr. Ace, can I talk to you?" I'm like, "Cool." It's like, and he tells me, like, "I didn't do my homework." I'm like, "Okay." And he's like, I'm like, "What's the reason?" He said, "You know, the lights have been out a few days in my house." I'm like, "Okay, yeah, definitely you have more time." Find out, like, a few weeks later, their parent comes to parent-teacher conference, and I find out that her mom works at McDonald's and works at another fast food place. Broke my heart. Literally just broke my heart, because this is a woman that is working her butt off to provide for her child, but can't provide properly due to the fact of the money she's getting paid. And to go off that statistic you said, with 52% of fast food workers on government assistance, well, that's costing over $7 billion to taxpayers. I mean, all us taxpayers do not want to pay that. So I don't understand why people don't see the light in making corporations pay, but when they want to pay for outside to other countries, to me, that's not really the American way of what we're founded on, taking care of. We're supposed to be, you know, the limelight, the view for the rest of the world to look at of what to do right, and we're not doing right. We're basically saying take care of other people, but not take care of in-house. So I just feel that it needs to be taken care of, and corporations can take care of that.
Chris, we only have a few minutes left. I'd like to let you have the last word here. For folks who are listening who are fast food workers, what is your message to them? How can they get involved if they're inspired by what they're hearing today?
My message to you to get involved is tell somebody. You don't have to be out and go out on strike if that's not you. You don't have to be the one that's always doing a Facebook status or something on social media. You can just have a conversation over a lunch with a coworker or a dinner with your family. Spreading the word is the best thing you could do. I'll leave this with you. If you're a witness to injustice and you don't talk about that, then you're part of injustice. You're accomplice to it. So don't be that. Spread justice and change the way.
Thank you very much. That's City Visions for this evening. Thank you all very much for joining us. My guests this evening were Jenny Lin, Deputy Director of the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, Chris Higginbotham, Campaigner for the Fight for 15 Movement, and John Logan, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State's College of Business. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join us next Monday as we discuss San Francisco's private shuttle industry. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.